Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your volume knob of music criticism. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff. And you're hearing Dimed Out from The Most Lamentable Tragedy, the new album by Titus Andronicus. Speaking about that today, my guest is Joe Coscarelli, our music reporter from The Times. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
Joe, you met with Patrick Stickles from Titus Andronicus recently before the band did, was it four nights?
Five nights
at Shea Stadium.
Shea Stadium, the best remaining DIY venue in Brooklyn.
Right. Little Room in Brooklyn, where Stickles has worked for a while.
Works quite often, I think, and the guitarist from Titus Andronicus is a founding member, I think.
Right. Well, so first, get our listeners on the page with us. Explain something about Titus Andronicus.
So this is a New Jersey punk band that's celebrating its 10-year anniversary with the release of this double album, which is almost an hour and a half long and almost 30 songs. They started out as pretty straightforward punk band, had a great debut, Airing of Grievances.
Yep. They're from Northern New Jersey.
Northern New Jersey.
Which is somewhat important to what they sing about
yes.
and their preoccupations.
Yeah, a lot of suburban angst in these songs.
Definitely.
Then they sort of came out as way more ambitious than anyone thought they were going to be with The Monitor, their first concept album.
Mm-hmm.
Do you love The Monitor, Ben?
I have complicated feelings about The Monitor, as I do. Well, my feelings about this record are a little less complicated, a little more just like, okay, guys, you got it. That was a good one. Well done. But anyway, The Monitor came out in 2010.
Yeah.
It's a record that was inspired by Stickles watched the Ken Burns Civil War documentary.
Right.
And he found ways to use the Civil War as a metaphor and to also write about suburban ennui and unhappiness and I think the end of a relationship.
Yep. Lofty goals to tie it all to the Civil War. A risk.
But any good songwriter probably can do it. He actually did it. Critics kind of went bananas.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a very highly rated album.
Fans, too, I think.
Fans, too.
They became sort of a real cult favorite band off of that album.
They did one more after that, and now we're at The Most Lamentable Tragedy, which is, as you said, a two-disc, five-act, hour-and-a-half-long opera, by their definition.
Yes.
Or song cycle, if you want to just leave it at that.
Punk opera.
Well, it's a specific kind of opera. In that the narrative is not totally clear. It's not A leads to B, leads to C, leads to D.
Right. There's time travel. There's dream sequences. There's a doppelganger.
Yes. Time travel. Talk about that.
At some point, he embodies a past ancestor.
Yeah.
An Irish immigrant living in New York City and is sort of talking about his depression, which is what this entire album is about, which we should have maybe mentioned off the bat.
We should have, actually. I mean, because this is a record about love, sex, drugs, doctors, blah, blah, blah. But it's basically about depression. He calls his condition manic depression. Stickles himself calls
yes.
his
depression. Very open about his health.
And so he's figured out a way to explore this topic in songs and also in structure. Hasn't he talked about, you know, the five acts of this thing mirroring five stages of, the depression cycle,
that? And it starts with him
waking up. And it almost closes with him going to bed. I think there's something after he goes to bed.
Yeah.
So you met with him. This is kind of a triumphant moment for him. He's been talking about making this record for a pretty long time.
Yeah, maybe four years or something.
Yes,
he had this plan well out, stemming from I think maybe his worst fit of mania and depression.
Yeah.
And he decided, you know, I'm going to make an album about this.
Did he tell you much about the worst fit of mania and depression?
Yeah. You know, he said it came during, I guess, the recording of the band's last album a little bit before. And he, you know, spent most of a year in bed only getting out for band responsibilities.
I've heard him say that during the darkest periods of that time, he just didn't write songs. You know, like there was maybe a whole year went by or something when he didn't write songs.
Yeah.
But then in a different state of mind, he can write lots of them. What's interesting is that this record, by extension, is also about the creative process. It's about different states of mind. It's about the manic depressive cycles. In the songs that are about the depressive parts of the cycle, the character is, you know, lifeless, basically. Can't do anything.
Right.
Can't get out of bed. But then in the manic phases, in those songs, he describes a character who is invincible.
And he also describes the things that get him there, which include drugs, both prescribed and not prescribed, a woman, love, that sort of thing. And songwriting and playing music. I feel like those are his main lifelines.
So this is a band that, well, he's 30, we should say. He just turned 30.
This record comes at a big time for Patrick Stickles, and I think he sees it as a culmination basically of everything he's been working on. It's not only the band's 10th anniversary, but it's released on his 30th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
It's constantly calling back to his previous works and the band's previous albums, and I think it's him sort of tying these four full lengths into a nice little bow. It almost feels like the band could end and the project would have been complete.
I think he's even said that himself.
Yeah, although I think he loves playing rock music too much to really hang it up.
Yeah. The fact that he's 30, and maybe the fact that he grew up in, is it Glen Rock, New Jersey, means that he's a punk, maybe, but he's a specific kind of punk.
Right.
And I think, as we were saying earlier, like, maybe his early experiences with punk was, you know, Rancid records. His initial inspiration was that wave of punk.
Right. It's sort of on the later end.
Did it actually go away? Did it die? I'm not sure. No, it didn't. It's like it's a sort of fast and streamlined kind of sound.
Big pop hooks, though.
Big pop hooks, exactly. Speaking of big pop hooks, he's also into a lot of music that is not punk, should we say? Some would consider not even very cool, you know? He's into straight-ahead late 70s FM radio, basically working class rock.
He is from New Jersey.
He is from New Jersey. So Bruce Springsteen, obviously, it's in the air. But on this record, you can also hear bits of, I hear a little AC/DC in the beginning, Thin Lizzy. Also, this is a band that loves to do covers.
Yep. I think they've been known to start their shows with The Boys Are Back in Town. I saw them play Thunder Road at Maxwell's in Hoboken. Rest in peace to Maxwell's.
Yeah.
Big, big band on bar rock covers.
How do you read it? Is this a complicated relationship with straight ahead bar rock?
I think there's a little smirk to it, a little irony, but maybe not much. I think ultimately, Patrick Stickles is nothing if not earnest. I think he sees the value in you know, a big guitar riff and a big guitar solo. There are a lot of guitar solos on this album.
That's true. Speaking of that, let's hear a little bit of a track called Lonely Boy. I'm minding my own business like I'm supposed to. So when I get home, no one's coming over. Shot down, tear and roll, rattle on my So there's Lonely Boy, a song about really the depths, and he's describing a state of mind in which the character can't even go outside.
This comes in Act One
of
the rock opera.
Yeah. Doesn't want to talk to anybody. But the music that accompanies those thoughts is real, like, Let's Party music. It kind of reminds me of Old Time Rock and Roll by Bob Seger.
Yeah.
Well, it has that riff that right. It's also in Suffragette City and a whole bunch. It's like, you know, famous, like, chugging riff. And also, like, really overused in rock. You know, it's like that riff is a big old cliche of good times, but he's using it in the context of this really deeply miserable song. I find that interesting.
I think he knows what he's doing. He's very clever. He loves making references and allusions to things musically and lyrically. He's, in addition to referencing himself, he's, you know, referencing the artists that I think inspired this album. And he comes right out and covers them on this album also. You know, he has a Daniel Johnson cover here, and then another song on the record with the same title.
Right.
And some of the same lyrics as the song he's covering, but it's his own version.
There's tons of echoes of all kinds of things. Like you say, an echo of a song elsewhere on the same record, echoes of songs and lyrics from earlier Titus Andronicus records, echoes of lyrics by other people.
Full of Easter eggs.
Yeah, it's full of Easter eggs. I guess that's the way to put it. But there's also an interconnectiveness in his body of work. Like, he seems to want to make everything connect. He seems obsessive about making everything connect.
I think he sees himself a little bit as a torchbearer, carrying this torch of rock and roll, which really doesn't exist in this pure of a form, at least in any mainstream capacity in terms of young bands.
Well, you saw the band at Shea Stadium on Monday.
I saw the band at Shea Stadium, which is also where I interviewed Patrick Sickles. So it really feels like, you know, their clubhouse. They were really on their home turf for this show.
And so what was the crowd like? Were they like, we don't care that rock and roll, you know, is slipping away, is a dying form, you know, the things that he likes to say, you know, how were they reacting?
I mean, you know, this is basically for these kids, I feel like it was like seeing, you know, U2 for them. For a DIY venue, it was very elaborately set up. There was no opener. There were black curtains in front of the stage held down with water bottles, water jugs. It was, you know, they had a big logo behind the stage. It was very elaborate, and it was a sweaty, sweaty room. I know you've been there.
So. No air conditioning, or just
there is an air conditioner,
bad air
but
conditioning.
You know, it's a wall unit.
Yeah,
yeah. So as soon as the band started playing, you know, there were sing-alongs. There was a mosh pit. Everyone was sweaty, but the show may have lost a little bit of energy because he was playing so many songs from this 93-minute rock opera that came out the day after the show. So people may have not been completely familiar with all the new songs.
Right.
That's always a challenge for a band playing from their new record, but more so when the band is so dependent on this community vibe and these raucous sing-alongs.
It's interesting that this is the time when bands do surprise attacks and, you know, the album comes out of nowhere. But I feel like I got an advanced copy of this a long time ago, it feels like. Longer than, you know, I got a longer lead time than usual. There's been, I don't know how many singles there's been in advance, but there's been songs out there.
And we knew what the plot of
we knew
the
what the plot
was.
He's been talking about it for 5 years or whatever. Also, there's a 15-minute video that came out, I guess maybe at the beginning of July.
Yeah.
It's kind of good, actually. It's like cheaply made but energetic, in which several of the songs are played. Three or four? I don't know.
Yeah. And they pre-sold this record. They basically did a Kickstarter without Kickstarter where they allowed pre-orders for this record before it had been recorded.
Yeah. How did that even work?
They have such a loyal fan base that, you know, I think they wanted to be held accountable. They said, we're going to make this five-act rock opera. Pay us for it so we can continue to make it so we don't have to tour. And it will, you know, hold our feet to the fire.
Similarly to the way that he was describing it to people before the whole thing was written or recorded or whatever.
In order to force himself to make it, basically.
Right. Well, okay. In your interview with him, an interesting concept came up. In your interview with him, you mentioned the fact that there are certain people out there, pop stars of various stripes, who will do a concept album but are unwilling to talk about it in great detail or to over-explain it. And you asked him, why are you explaining it?
Just explaining it, but, you know, providing literature with the album that says exactly what's happening in every song and
right.
what each character is doing at any given moment.
So what was his response?
His response was that he didn't want it to be misinterpreted. He said he wrote this record about something very specific, his manic depression, and he didn't want to leave any room for people to say it was about something he wasn't about. He also didn't want to be misinterpreted. And he brought up a specific example of a band that he's toured with, a punk band from Toronto, whose name we don't say on this program.
That's right.
But they made a record called David Comes to Life.
As I recall from your interview, he said that he was haunted by what he saw around the release of that record.
Which was basically critics, maybe like yourself,
yeah.
saying, this is a fine record. They say it's a rock opera. Doesn't really matter what it's about. You can't understand the lyrics anyway.
Well, for reference with that, let's insert here a little bit of an interview that I did with two members of the band that cannot be named, the 8 band from Toronto, when their record David Comes to Life came out. They came into the studio and we talked to them. And I asked them that question.
Well, I got to confess something to you, which is that I have not read the lyrics to the record by choice.
Oh.
Because for me, your band is entirely about sound. Not the lyrics are beside the point, but it's the sound does everything.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's another song, Year of the Ox.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Without knowing what the lyrics were, because when I heard it, half of the lyrics were in French.
Yeah.
You know that it's a song about struggle and persistence and then sort of ecstasy. In a sense, that's all you have to know. So I wonder, what are you hearing from people? Are you hearing like people are really getting into reading all the lyrics, trying to figure out the story, you know, putting it all together?
Absolutely. I mean, there's obviously a lot to decipher in David Comes to Life. And I think that in recent memory, you might be the only person who has referred to that record as a full sound. And I think that's really important because as much as we are a band like anybody else that's about music and lyrics, we're really about everything together. And considering the sort of differences between the melodic, shimmering aspects of some of the music and the harsh aspects of the vocals, but also that they're connected by the fact that they're really loud guitars, I think it's important to understand 8 as a full sound. It's like one thing absolutely goes with the other, and you have to take it in all at once. And now, you know, that's not to discount anything about the lyrics, of course. That's
right.
It's important, and that's something that's been running through the whole band. But I do think that's an important designation that you've made.
So that was Damian Abraham and Jonah Falco, the singer and the drummer from the band from Toronto that made the record David Comes to Life. And what Jonah was saying there was when they make a record, they want it to be considered as an integrated whole. I was being deliberately provocative with them, because they're nice guys. I knew they wouldn't slug me. But I kind of believe what I said,
right.
That, you know, that is a group that, for me anyway, boils down to sound, like a real super-duper triple-decker sound experience. And the voice is part of that sound. But the lyrics, in my enjoyment of them, actually are secondary. I feel a bit differently about this record.
And I think Patrick Sickles does too.
About this record? About his own record?
About his lyrics and how closely they need to be paid attention to.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, a part of my interview with him that got cut out, he said, you know, this is a quote he said, I've heard a bunch of these indie hipster bands, so-called punk bands today, say, oh yeah, I wrote all my lyrics in an afternoon because I don't care. I'm a rocker and this is meaningless. That's good for them, he said. But you have a better time with it if you actually see what the point is. If you want to just tap your foot to it, that's fine. But the option is there to really know what's going on.
You know, in the media these days, there's so much attention to, like, the story behind the story and the, you know, the shadow narrative. And this is what readers and viewers and listeners want to know about. They get a sense of, you know, extra value from all that. And I feel like he's satisfying that desire enormously. To understand this record, The Most Lamentable Tragedy, reading the lyrics is helpful. reading interviews with him is helpful because he talks directly about – he just like jumps right into the fire pit, you know? I mean, there are other records out there about depression, famously so even.
Really?
I'm thinking of a Nick Drake record.
Right.
I'm thinking of a record by The Cure, 17 Seconds, is that what it's called? I'm thinking of an Elliott Smith record.
All the Elliott Smith records.
Oh, I guess all the Elliott Smith records. They're not unified wholes in the way that this one is. And they treat the subject highly metaphorically sometimes. And
metaphors aren't very punk, Ben.
I know that Patrick Sickles does like metaphors, but there's a little more directness in these songs. And he's done that before. He's been direct in amazing ways. And maybe I think that's what his fans have come to admire about him.
I think that's definitely part of it. I mean, there are not only songs on this album called I Lost My Mind, but also I'm Going Insane.
Yes.
In which he just says, I'm going insane over and over again.
Let's talk about the fact that here's a rock and roll band playing a kind of music, I'm talking about punk, that may or may not be dead. Having a good time playing covers of songs that are old sentimental favorites, not particularly current. And here's a double album that's going to take a lot of your time in order to absorb it properly, in order to get the most value out of it. It really does take a lot of time and energy. And it's an album. It's an album.
It's not an album for Spotify.
No.
It's not a few good singles. This is not Fetty Wap. This is a double album that you're supposed to listen to front to back and which will take as long as a film.
So is he a true believer or is he somebody who is really deeply into the futility of what he's doing? Do you know what I'm saying?
I sense you're leaning in a direction on this question.
I don't really know the answer. Is he rock and roll till I die? Or is he, I understand that I'm involved in an endeavor that is increasingly meaningless?
Can he be both? I think he might be both.
Yeah.
I think he is rock and roll till he dies. I think he's, you know, devoted a prime 10 years of his life to this project, and it means everything to him. But I don't think he's delusional about the fact that there are probably fewer people who are going to sit down and listen to a double punk album today than maybe there were in any decade before this, since the beginning of punk.
It's funny, though, there is something old-fashioned about what he's doing. Like, there is a tradition of punk operas already. You know what I mean? Like, we can say, oh, a punk opera, how counterintuitive. But it's been done.
Yeah.
He's not the first.
No. Green Day has one.
Right? Also, punk double albums. If one of the definitive energies or concepts in punk is brevity, lack of pretentiousness, or whatever, that fence has been jumped over also a long time ago.
Because of the no rules ethos.
By Husker Du and the Minutemen and more recently Tenement, you know? Yes, exactly, because of the no rules ethos. I find what's going on now in punk kind of interesting. I feel like there's a renewed interest in that no rules ethos, in the idea that punk is not really a defined set of sounds, a defined mode of resistance. It's a very general sense of doing what you want to do.
And I think, you know, we've seen this in the DIY scene in the past few years, whether it's, you know, not only putting things out on vinyl, but on cassette, and you're really forcing people to, you know, make an effort to listen to this music. And this takes it beyond form and really puts it all out there with an album that's not made for the era that we live in.
Well, one more element that we didn't really talk about music-wise on this record is the Irish part. If you love Irish sing-alongs, if you love rock and roll that reminds you of that kind of thing, you might love parts of this record.
Dropkick Murphys fans, get on this.
Yes, exactly. They do a Pogues cover.
They do a Pogues cover. A nice one.
They actually toured with the Pogues. I read somewhere in an English newspaper that they were taken aback by the Pogues' lack of interest in them. I think Stickles takes the Pogues very seriously.
Who doesn't?
Loves them.
Yeah.
And kind of couldn't understand, you know, why maybe they didn't watch them from backstage.
You know
they
what punks say about their idols?
Oh, kill them? Yes, right. So there's this Irish thing, and maybe we should close this with one of their Irish songs, which is Come On, Siobhan. It's also maybe the only true love song on the record.
The love doesn't last very long, I think, when you're in the middle of a fit of manic depression.
Joe Coscarelli, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
She's walking down the street. She's looking for someone I'd like to speak to. After school, up to the time of attendance, she's looking silently as dead as she ever had. Oh, come on, come on.
That's our show, and thank you for listening. You can read Joe Coscarelli's interview with Patrick Stickles of Titus Andronicus and my review of The Most Lamentable Tragedy at nytimes.com/music. Our producers are Tamara Best and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can find the music of Titus Andronicus and their idols on our Spotify playlist. Have a good week. See you next time.